Adam Goodhart is one of the few outsiders to make eye contact with the hunter-gatherer Sentinelese people. He's with us on Travel with Rick Steves to explain the issues that come up when protecting the privacy of uncontacted islanders from the influences and diseases of the outside world. Adam wrote The Last Island to tell their story. He's also featured in a National Geographic documentary about the island called The Mission. Adam also directs the Star Center for the Study of the American Experience at Washington College in Chesterton, Maryland. They examine the complexity of American history and what it can teach us today. I got to tell you, Adam, I'm just so caught up in this. It's fascinating. And looking at your book, there's collections of historic photographs that illustrate the glancing connections that different curious, caring anthropologists, travelers, adventure seekers, whatever, have found with the Sentinelese people. And you look at a photo of them being taught how to shake hands or something like that. I mean, there's stuff that we think is just fundamental. Human beings, you know, they wave hello or they would shake hands. And these people would be totally apart from that, wouldn't they?
Yeah, so the Andaman Islands are a very isolated place, not just geographically, but also culturally. And also genetically, the native people of the Andamans look very different from other South Asians. They are extremely dark-skinned. They're some of the darkest-skinned people in the world. They're quite small. They're almost the size of African pygmies. And they're thought to have been separate from the rest of humanity for as much as 70,000 years, based on the few genetic studies that have been able to be done.
And they've developed their own sort of wardrobe and their fashion styles. I mean, they look like they wear similar, not clothing, but bark belts and necklaces and so on.
Yeah, they've developed a whole range of very distinctive cultures. And of course, what we know about them isn't so much based on the Sentinelese, who remain almost totally out of touch, but on some of the other tribes that have had contact with the outside world. And that process really largely began in the mid-1800s when the British settled much of the Andaman Islands and started turning it into a penal colony.
Do they have industry? Because you have photographs of them laying on a woven mat. Somebody had to weave that mat. I mean, we have the surname Weaver. Well, that was somebody who used to weave. And they have bow and arrows. And we have the surname Fletcher, somebody who used to put the feathers on an arrow. And they have what functions as jewelry. Do different people specialize and make something, or does everybody make everything for themselves?
These are very skillful craftspeople, and they don't really have industry, but some of the artifacts that they create are absolutely beautiful. While I was there on my first visit, I actually met someone who had found a Sentinelese bow floating in the waters off North Sentinel Island when he was there assisting with a shipwreck that had happened. And he had brought this bow back and he handed it to me, and it was just this gorgeous thing, just a beautifully shaped piece of wood with countless incised lines all over it, making elaborate patterns and painted with a sort of a red ochre paint. And so clearly these are people with a strong visual culture and a lot of skill in how they interact with the world.
And they must have some kind of religion, and a totally apart religion from any of the other religions on this planet. There was also a photo of a girl wearing her sister's skull, and there must have been a story about that.
Yes, that's something that is done among many of the Andamanese tribes. When a loved one dies, they'll set their body out to decay, and then they'll gather up the bones and actually wear the skull or sometimes a jawbone or a leg bone around their neck. And you can imagine that this has been somewhat disconcerting for visitors to the islands who were unprepared to see this. And it fed some of the early rumors that these people were cannibals, which is completely untrue. They've never been cannibals. They've never been headhunters. In fact, the only records that I found of cannibalism and headhunting were perpetrated by the European settlers themselves under various circumstances, which is a complicated part of the history. But yeah, their religions are very different. And as far as we can tell, none of the native tribes of the Andaman Islands practice any kind of religious worship. They believe that the world is inhabited by both natural and supernatural beings. They don't make a strong distinction between what's natural and what's supernatural in the world, but they just believe that they kind of exist in this realm. And there aren't the kinds of attempts to pray or to propitiate divinities that we're used to from most other human cultures. There's also, as far as we can tell, no real sort of organized government, no hierarchy among them. They live in small tribal groups and they make their decisions by consensus. So in some ways, it's a kind of a paradise, depending on whom you ask, I suppose, but it sounds pretty good to me.
And they've been blessed with apparently no natural resources that would want to cause anybody else to invade them. You know, they talk about the curse of oil. You know,
if
they had something valuable there, they wouldn't exist today, but they've been untouched. Nobody has bothered to take them over.
Well, part of it is that nobody has bothered to take them over, and part of it is that they have done a very good job defending themselves. And I think we have to give them credit. And I think we also have to understand, and I discovered this through doing research in archives all over the world, that they have had glancing contacts here and there with other groups that have been enough to leave them reeling and leave them understanding that this is not something that they want and that danger can come from the water.
They're fully aware that there's a big world out there and they like what they've got. Oh, man. You know, Adam, this is a show where it's about travel and we sort of promote tourism, but there's no way we're going to promote tourism to North Sentinel Island.
But I'm glad.
Of course not. Yeah, but the Andaman Islands, do they have much tourism there? And what would you just say briefly about the opportunity to travel to the Andaman Islands?
So tourism to the Andaman Islands is growing fast and really has been for the past decade or so. And as I said, these islands look like a sort of a tropical dream in a lot of ways. They're not terribly difficult to get to as long as you can get to India. And so for the time being, at least most of the tourists there are from mainland India. It's become sort of a popular honeymoon destination for people from mainland India. So it's almost a Hawaii-like place for them. But there are more and more outsiders as well, and more and more sort of 3- and 4-star hotels and ecotourism resorts. And the Indian government really wants to develop tourism a lot, although this, of course, could be problematic in that it'll put pressure on the natural resources, on the fragile environment, and on the native people.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been joined by Adam Goodhart. His book is The Last Island, Discovery, Defiance, and the Most Elusive Tribe on Earth. Adam, thanks again for joining us. And is there one takeaway that you'd like your readers to leave your book with? What can we learn from tribes like the Sentinelese?
So first of all, I hope that people who read my book will understand that this sort of worldwide drama, this worldwide struggle of indigenous groups against non-indigenous colonizers and explorers isn't something that ended in 1492. This is something that's going on still in different places around the world today, and there are still groups that are under threat. And not only are the individuals in those groups under threat and in peril from things like alien diseases and degradation of their environment, but their entire cultures are also under acute threat. And these are cultures that are incredibly sophisticated cultures from which we have a whole lot to learn, cultures with their own art, with their own history, with their own kinds of literature, with their own kinds of social organization, with their own knowledge of the world that surrounds them. And we still, as a civilization, have to very carefully account for the existence of those people and try not to make the same mistakes that were made so many times in the past by colonizers and explorers who came into places and destroyed the things that they were discovering and the people that they were discovering.
Adam Goodhart, with a last name that really mirrors your approach to this beautiful slice of humanity. Thank you very much for writing The Last Island, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
You'll find web links to our guests with the notes for each week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. For an excursion into the old world powers of Europe, don't overlook the delights of Portugal. As a maritime power, its New World colonies made it one of the wealthiest nations of the 15th century. Portugal endured a fascist regime for much of the 20th century. Today, it's an attractive and affordable destination whose traditions include great food, lively arts, and soulful music. After a few days in its capital, Lisbon, or along the beaches of the Algarve, A nice way to get in touch with Portugal's history and its today is in the prestigious university town of Coimbra. Coimbra comes with a youthful college town vibe and a walkable Arab-flavored old town. And it's just a couple hours north of Lisbon. To tell us more about what you'll find in the Oxford of Portugal, we're joined now by Lisbon-based tour guide Cristina Duarte. Cristina, thanks for being here.
Welcome. De nada.
Cristina, what makes Coimbra unique to you as a Portuguese person?
It's traditions linked with the university. The city has been developing a little bit on the shade of the university since the end of the 1200s, actually. It makes a huge impact in the city because we are talking about 23,000 students that actually have an impact in the city.
So this is the university town in Portugal.
Yes.
If you want that youthful university is kind of fun.
Yes, it's from those 23,000, about 6,000 are foreigner.
Is that right? Okay, so there's a little bit of cosmopolitan
action
there. And just the vibrancy that a university town will have. Now, I understand Lisbon was controlled by the Moors when they came in from Africa.
Yes.
And during that period, for almost 200 years, Coimbra was...
The capital of Portugal.
The capital.
Because Portugal was basically just north and center of Portugal. And Coimbra was the capital. It was the edge between the Catholics and the Moorish. So that's why our first king, second king, they were born and buried. Well, they were not buried in Coimbra, but definitely they are buried
they
there.
and that's where they would have ruled from. And this university being, you said the university was founded,
In the end of the 1200s.
So that must be one of the oldest universities in Europe.
Oldest when they started, but the building of the university, it's not from the 1200s, but in this case it was an old royal palace from the 1500s.
Now, when I go to Coimbra, I always seem to stumble into fun traditions among the students. What are some of the student traditions we might see as tourists when we visit Coimbra?
Well, definitely the beginning of the school year, which is with initiation, and you find, you can notice easily which are the ones having the initiation, because on the first year, the students of the university, they are not allowed to wear the university uniform.
Is this a robe?
Yes, it's a robe. They didn't acquire yet the respect for having the university
So the first year students are sort of getting...
Having a hard time, yes.
And then it's so fun when you go around town because you see windows filled with photographs of the graduating classes and you see people decked out.
And that is the second top moment of the school year, which is in May, and it lasts for 1 week. It starts with a serenade, which is absolutely... breathless, is beautiful. It seems a little bit a bad convention because of the black cape of the students. And the serenade takes place at midnight front.
What kind of a convention?
A bat.
So a bunch of bats.
Because they do look like bats
with their black capes. And then they all get together. And then what is breathtaking about it?
It's the environment, the atmosphere at midnight, because it must be taken at midnight in front of the cathedral, on the steps of the cathedral. And it's full of people. It's beautiful.
So as a traveler, if you're there in the spring, you're very likely to be able to see some of the festivities relating to graduation.
Yes.
And if you're going there any time of year, you can visit different buildings from the university. My favorite building was the library. Tell us about the library.
The library, it makes part of the campus, but when I'm talking about the university, I'm talking about a campus that is coming from a palace, from a royal palace from the 1500s. That was added building on the 1600s, the 1700s, and the library that we are talking about, it's from the 1700s, Baroque style. And inside is the most impressive collection of books, not very old books, but I'm telling you that the amount for that period where having a book was almost... having like a diamond,
thing. Yes. Yeah, a diamond. Well, you get the sense of a book as a diamond when you go into this library, and it's so ornately decorated with inlaid tables with hardwood from South America and Brazilian gold leaf everywhere, and a big giant key that the attendant uses to open the door and let you in.
It seems like St. Peter.
It does. It seems like a precious religious place almost, and it's the library. Cristina Duarte is our guide to one of Europe's charming second cities. We're talking about the distinguished university town and one-time capital of Portugal, Coimbra, right now on Travel with Rick Steves.
Christina's website is lisbonbeyond.pt. And when you're in Coimbra, Coimbra, just a couple hours north of Lisbon, you also have a chance to hear a unique kind of folk music, the fado, performed by men. Tell us about fado and how it's different in Coimbra.
Mainly because the students were men. Right now is exactly the opposite. Women are more attending university than men. But on the past, it was mainly men. And so they developed this music, especially music turned to women to it's not flirting. I would like to, another more
elegant word.
Elegant word. We have that word in Portuguese, means cortejar.
Oh, it's courting.
Courting.
So these are troubadours.
Yes.
And they will court women with
With their voices, with their guitars, singing these songs of the serenades. And they are very important for that. But of course that it's not only love music. Coimbra has a university city also. On the 60s became very much of a political movement. Mm-hmm. And some of these Coimbra songs, they can be also about freedom and can be about against the regime.
Well, you had the dictator there.
Yes.
And in America, we had liberal people in universities raising their voice for various social concerns.
Mm-hmm.
The same years, you had liberal people in universities speaking out against the dictatorship of Salazar. Today, when we go there, we can see these male fado groups in the streets and in the restaurants. You can go to a restaurant and enjoy some beautiful music.
It's not that easy. I would rather recommend to have a place where you are sure that you are going to have some fado music. Because it's students, is that probably today there is, but if they find another party, a better party to go, they will go.
Ah.
So you see, don't rely so much unless the restaurant tells you, we are going to have fados today. Otherwise, don't expect that you find groups of player
just
performances
accidentally. So look for a restaurant that advertises.
Exactly.
Fado.
And right now, there are some groups also that provide in a regular basis, everyday basis.
And that's reasonably good quality for the
It's
fado.
A reasonable, very good quality, nice quality.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Christina Duarte about the third city of Portugal, Coimbra, but in some ways it's the first city. It's the university city, and for a couple of hundred years it was the capital of Portugal, and today it's a very charming way to complement your visit to Lisbon is to go to the smaller town, Coimbra. Christina, if you are going to recognize that somebody is from Coimbra, how can you tell somebody's from Coimbra?
Probably because he or her will call me doctor. Instead of Mr. or Mrs., many times they call the others the Dr. Christina, Dr. Rick.
Oh, because that's their culture.
Because
they
their culture is that it's a kind of a funny thing, is that as they were so many licensed people with the degrees, so many times they didn't want it to risk to to not call a doctor proper name, a proper title. So,
Dr. Christina Duarte, obrigado.
Thank you very much. Obrigada, Dr. Rick.
I'll see you in Coimbra. Coimbra, velha guitarra, serás sempre a minha amante. Coimbra, velha guitarra, serás sempre a minha amante.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton with Casmara Hall and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Look at Rick's checklist for what to pack in your suitcase and share tips with fellow travelers. It's part of our online travel forum that you'll find at ricksteves.com. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.